What I want to do with you tonight, just to give you a feel for going to space, run you very quickly through a whole trip of going to space and try and set the tone for the rest of the week in terms of what space is all about. We're going to move fairly quickly. The first thing in going to space is obviously a crew gets named about 12 months before the flight. And you do flight-specific training. And one of the first things you do is you design your own patch. At least in America, each spaceflight crew has its own patch. And this was ours. It's obviously very American. Don't know how you guess that. Just a few things about it, though. It was originally, I think, designed to be the 17th space shuttle flight. In those early days of the space shuttle, of course, things didn't happen as they were supposed to happen, and when it came to be fact, it turns out that we were the 13th shuttle flight. But I think there's 17 stars on the flag. That was going to designate the 17th flight. It's a very unusual patch for a couple of reasons. First of all, is the symbolism in the middle, the star and the goal, all the goal symbolism. Let me explain that. That is the astronaut symbol. I think it's the only flight patch that it exists on. And the reasoning behind that symbolism is that the star at the top is obviously you reach for the stars. The three vertical lines are showing three paths of getting to the stars. And what that really means is that astronauts are a pretty varied bunch and they come from all walks of life, all sorts of directions. So it signifies the variation that you have across the astronaut corps. There's no two astronauts who are similar, I can assure you. And the circle surrounding those paths is to show unity, which is to show that, you know, you have to work as a team no matter how different you are. Because if you go to space, it is a risky business. We all learned that in the Challenger disaster. It's very risky, but you try and minimize that risk by working together as a team. Then, interesting enough, that this 13th shuttle flight made a little bit of history. It was the first time two women had gone to space together, and in order to note that on the patch, if you look very carefully, after each name there's a symbol, and those symbols are a sort of a modernistic sex symbol if you look carefully, and therefore you can easily figure out which are the women. For those who can't figure it out, if you start off, God, you're a bright mob, is Kathy Sullivan and Sally Ride. And we had the Canadian Marc Garneau at the same time. This makes it easier to figure out who are the men and who are the women. Little bit of trivia, it turns out that I was the first person ever or since to go to space with a beard. Most important if you have one. A little bit about the training. You think this is an easy job? But seriously, the training is very intense. For example, you spend a lot of times in simulators, high fidelity simulators in Houston. There's a lot of crews in training at any one time. The simulators run around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. If it's your turn to be in the simulator at 2 a.m. on a Sunday morning, then guess what time you're in the simulator. That the training for flight crew training is certainly not a 9 to 5 job 5 days a week, and I can assure you. You probably figure out which one is me. It's very difficult to simulate zero gravity on Earth. The way we do it is we have a KC-135 plane, which is the military equivalent to a Boeing 707. We strip all the seats out of it. We pad it. We take it up to about 43,000 feet. We cut the engines. We free fall the plane for 10,000 feet. And so what happens is, you learned today in the talk that when something is free falling, it's very much similar to being in zero gravity. We saw some very vivid demonstrations of that earlier today. And so the plane is free falling for 10,000 feet. You're free falling inside the plane, and relative to the plane, it's still surrounding you. You're falling at the same rate, the same acceleration. And so it's very similar to zero gravity. A couple of things to keep in mind. It takes 29.7 seconds for a 707 to free fall 10,000 feet. You get to know that very precisely because it's great to float around, but at that precise point when they start the engines again, you go from zero G's to 2 G's instantaneously, and if you're in some sort of awkward position, you either hurt yourself or someone else. So you learn to count those seconds very, very carefully. Part of the training, which is you don't hear about in the textbooks, is you have to be able to drive an army tank. And you say, what the hell's that for? Well, it's called survival. When you're sitting in there on the pad, sitting on a big bomb, and something goes wrong, I can assure you that no one's around to help you. The closest person is over 3 miles away. They're not dumb. And so you're on your own. And there's various escape methods of getting out of the pad. Say we have a fire on the pad or something. But once you get out of the vehicle and get to the ground, you have to get the hell out of there. So they have an army tank literally parked alongside the pad. And seeing there's no one around to help you, you all tumble into the tank. Well, you never know what condition you're going to be in. You never know who's going to end up sitting in the driver's seat. So everyone on the crew has to be trained to drive that tank to get out of there. Fortunately, we've never had to use that, but you have to go through the training. Some of the training is a bit more interesting, a bit more fun, a bit more exciting. These are our little sports cars. They're T-38 training planes. Anyone who knows about military planes, it's the equivalent of an F-5. Northrop F-5 fighter plane. It's supersonic. It has an extremely short wingspan. For example, I can lie on a wing of an F-5 with my head against the fuselage, and although my feet don't overlap the edge of the wing, they're very close to it. Short wings give you high maneuverability. You can easily do a 360 roll in under a second. You can go supersonic, they're highly stable. You can flip one, fly it inverted, and that's a stable configuration to fly. In fact, one of my favorite stunts was to take one out over the Gulf of Mexico, invert, and then look up through the canopy at the ocean. And I got away with that, saying this is an oceanographic training flight. This is a photograph we took. This is the Challenger being ferried back from Edwards Air Force Base down to the Cape Canaveral in Florida for our particular flight. The city that you see behind in the background under the nose of the 747 is in fact the city of Houston. The Johnson Space Center where we train is just south of Houston. So this was literally flying directly over the Johnson Space Center. Took this photograph. And I can assure you, at this point in time, when you see that, you see the shuttle coming overhead for your flight, it suddenly dawns on you, you're really going to do it. The other point about this slide is that it very graphically and vividly shows you how big the orbiter is relative to a 747. As I say, you do most of your training at Houston. You go to the Cape about a week before the flight. You stay in the crew quarters. The crew quarters is about 5.5 miles from the pad. And so that to get to the pad, in our case in the morning of launch, you have to have this bus here that you crew bus that goes from the crew quarters. We launched literally at the point of dawn, one times one's launch, depending on what one has to do, because we had to launch a satellite to get to the right point at the right time to launch the satellite. That controls the launch time. So that means that you suit up. In our case, we suited up. Dawn in those cases at that particular point in time was 7 o'clock in the morning. We suited up about midnight, get into the bus, go down to the pad about 3:30 in the morning, go up to the white room, get on the orbiter, and I'll show you that. Here we are. You've heard about the white room. Let me assure you, it's not a white room. What it is you go up to the access level of the orbiter. You go along a rickety old pathway that's sort of cantilevered out off the launch pad, and at the end of this pathway they've got some white canvas at the end where you finally put on your helmet and go into the orbiter, and that's the so-called white room. If you look past the head of the technician there, you can see a circular hatch. That's the access hatch to the orbiter. Something about, and you can see you put on the helmet at this particular point in time. Interestingly enough, when you finally crawl into the orbiter, it's a different sensation, and the reason is that the orbiter's vertical at this point. Don't forget the seats are very much as they are in this room. Let's say we tipped this room 90 degrees, made this room vertical. Think about climbing into the orbiter. You literally have to crawl over the back to the seats to get to your own seat. Think about that. It turns out that's not a trivially easy thing to do. That's what you look like when you're ready to go. Starting from the top, there's the helmet. The black thing on the top of the helmet is just a little piece of woolen cloth. And what that is that's a protective cloth that goes over your visor. The visor, in fact, has a very light coating of pure gold. And when you're crawling into the orbiter, you really don't want to get that scratch. So you put this little beanie, they call it, over the gold faceplate. When you want to be in an oxygen environment, that faceplate comes down. You can see the seal. You get the oxygen by, when you're in your seat, you plug in. There's an orange cord and a white cord. The orange cord is you plug that in, you can control your oxygen supply, just like a jet fighter. The white cord is your communications. You've got to be able to have several-way communication. You've got to be able to talk to fellow crew members. You've got to be able to talk to launch control down the Cape. You've got to be able to talk to mission control in Houston. And you have to have all these communication lines open at one time. The way we've got it configured is we just plug the one cord. The white cord has all the circuits on it. Oh, the little thing on the right here, the rubber ball, that's a little air ball that you can blow up a lumbar pad that's on the back of your just here at the lower part of your back. The reason is, especially if you go through some pad holes, it's not unusual to hold on the pad for 6, 7, 8 hours strapped in your chair. Don't forget, at that point you are lying on your back and it can become quite uncomfortable. So that's just a lumbar pad that you can adjust to suit yourself. The rest of the harness business that you see around there, that's all for various escape modes. It's very much like a mountaineering the harness. For example, if you have to land in the water off the Cape, you come out the top, you have ropes, you come down, you rappel down ropes, and the harness is very useful for things like that.